Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. I enjoyed the lectures very much. So I will talk about elliptic characteristic classes, Boole varieties, and 3D mirror symmetry. The work I'm going to report on is work in progress with graduate student Ian Xu, and I will also touch upon results we proved with co-authors Andrzej Weber, Andrei Smirnov, Varchenko, Zijun Zhu. And I must say that I learned a lot from discussions with Lev Rozonsky. In this slide, I want to summarize in just one sentence this whole lecture. The summary is that in the theory of characteristic classes of singularities, which I do, after a while, we started to do elliptic characteristic classes. And that led us to new discoveries. Some beautiful new structure is revealed if you lift your characteristic classes to the elliptic world. And that's what I want to report today. I decided to give you a walkthrough of the talk. In the first 5 minutes or so, I will actually go through the whole talk. And after I restart and give you the details. Here is where the walkthrough begins. So the main theme is that we are given some smooth ambient variety and a possibly singular subvariety in it. We want to associate its fundamental class, which lives in the cohomology of the ambient space. What is the fundamental class? Intuitively, you take the fundamental homology class lives in the top homology of sigma, and you push it forward to M. And you have a homology in M, and you use some kind of Poincaré duality in M to map it into the cohomology of M. So that's the fundamental class, and that's already a very, very deep invariant of this singular variety. Half of enumerative geometry can be phrased with the usage of this characteristic class. Of course, when the theory of characteristic classes developed, sooner or later people realized that we should do this equivariantly. So imagine that on this whole situation, a torus acts. And of course, then the characteristic class not lives in cohomology, but equivariant cohomology. So that's innocent. But in the last few years, the new development is that instead of the fundamental class, we should consider an age-deformed version of it. An age-deformed version of the characteristic class starts with the fundamental class, but it has higher order, higher cohomological degree terms. There are several ways of thinking about what this age deformation is. In cohomology, it is classically known as the Chern-Schwarz-McPherson class. In K-theory, it's called the Motivic-Chern class. And there's an elliptic version as well. And I already jumped into my next line, that this notion of characteristic class should be not considered in cohomology, but in higher cohomology theories, K-theory, elliptic cohomology, or equivariant elliptic cohomology. Anyway, the bottom line of the story is that if you have this geometric setup, a singular subvariety in a smooth ambient space, and at the end of the day, we will have an elliptic class associated to this object, and that will live in the equivariant elliptic cohomology of the ambient space. By the nature of the subject, it will depend on some equivariant variables because at least a torus is acting. But by the nature of the subject, we will be forced to use some new parameters, which are called sometimes dynamical parameters, sometimes scalar parameters or variables, or sometimes FI parameters in physics. Anyway, these are just parameters that this elliptic class depends on. Okay, so now you have this elliptic characteristic class associated to a singular variety, and then you and your friends and your students and people start calculating elliptic classes of objects. For example, you start with some partial flag varieties, including the full flag variety. So you consider the contingent flag variety that has some nice holomorphic symplectic form, and you calculate the elliptic classes. And you find that this space is self-dual in this sense, in the following sense, that the elliptic classes of one side of a duality are the same as the elliptic classes on the other side of the duality, except you have to replace the equivariant and the dynamic parameters. And also you replace H with H inverse. This equality is somewhat sophisticated. I have to come back to it later. But roughly speaking, that's what it happens, that for the contingent bundle of the full flag variety, if you replace the equivariant parameters with the dynamic parameters, and you replace H with H inverse, you roughly get back to the same elliptic classes. So there is this new symmetry that was not visible in on the K-theory level and then the cohomology level. This is proved in a paper with Weber and also a paper with Smirnov, Barchenko, Zhu. But then if you have this story, then it's natural to ask the question that maybe other partial flag varieties also have some duals. But you look for those duals in among partial flag varieties and you don't find. So you look outside of partial flag varieties, and indeed you will find some among Nakajima Kriver varieties. Nakajima Kriver varieties are again holomorphic syntactic manifolds that are associated to combinatorial objects like this one. So essentially a chain. I have to stop here and I have to say that everything I do is type A. So I will not consider more difficult Lie theory or more difficult graphs, just a chain graph. Anyway, so a type A Nakajima Kriver variety is a chain of vertices with edges, some dimension vector associated, and each vertex has a framing. Anyway, it turns out that the contingent bundle of a Grassmannian has a dual, which is a Nakajima Kriver variety. I only wrote Grassmann 2C5 as an example, but for every Grassmannian, this is true. You go a little bit deeper and you will find some others. So for this Nakajima Kriver variety, that will be the dual. So that's somewhat satisfying that spaces come in pairs such that the elliptic characteristic classes match if you replace equivariant and killer parameters. But there are two problems with this picture that we have at this point. One problem is that the proof, the proof here is very difficult. So it depends on very sophisticated usage of theta function identities and residue calculus and so on. And you feel that if this is a fundamental concept, a fundamental symmetry among these two spaces, then the proof should just follow. The other problem with this picture is that there are Nakajima Kriver varieties whose dual is not among the Nakajima Kriver varieties. Actually, even here, if you consider, for example, the Grassmannian of T star Grassmann 3C5, then the dual among the Nakajima Kriver varieties, there is no dual.
Yeah.
I hear somebody talking. Is this a question or maybe probably just a mistake? Right. Anyway, so the proposal is that there is an even bigger set of varieties. This is the main protagonist of today's talk, Cherkis-Bow varieties. Cherkis-Bow varieties are also holomorphic synthetic manifolds. Such they are encoded by combinatorial codes. This will be a combinatorial code which encodes it. The combinatorial code consists of different loop lines.
Sorry, may I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Hello? Oh yeah, so in this blue example, so how do you see this 2-5 in the Kriver variety side?
Can you repeat slower? I'm sorry, probably my internet connection is.
Yeah, so the T star Grassmannian 2 in C5. So yes. This number 2 and 5, can you see it from the diagram in the quiver right side?
Yeah, so the quiver language of this is the quiver picture of this is that.
No, in the dual side, in the Nakajima quiver right side.
Yes. This is a symplectic variety.
So 2 corresponds to...
Oh, that is a mystery. It's not something you can read from these numbers. Actually, by the end of the talk, I will give an algorithm to go from here there. But when we proved this theorem that we were dual in this characteristic class sense, then we did not know it was a sort of an educated guess / talking with physicists.
Thank you.
Sure. I think somebody's background noise is coming at least to my speakers. Okay, but that's a very good question, that if you see this Grassmannian or this, how do you guess this other one? That will be answered by the Bo variety picture. Because that's what I'm in the middle of, that in Bo varieties, the suggested duality will be just replace one kind of combinatorial code with the other combinatorial code. So you see the combinatorial relation between these two pictures so far. A slanted line is replaced with a vertical line, and the vertical line is replaced with a slanted line, and the numbers don't change. Anyway, all of these will be given more details, but that is going to be the topic of today's lecture. I want to talk about characteristic classes a little bit, and then I want to advertise Cherkis Bo varieties. This is the end of the walkthrough. So in the rest of the lecture, there will be these two parts. I will sketch some introduction about elliptic characteristic classes, and then that will be very, very brief, but mostly I want to talk about Bo varieties. Any other questions? Okay, if not, then let's go to elliptic characteristic classes. Again, this will be just a sketch. Mostly I want you guys to consider it as a black box, but still I want to give an example. The example will be T star of P2. So this is a variety. It has a three torus acting because P2 is just the quotient by C3. On that C3, we are acting by the three torus. And there's an extra C star acting on the fiber directions just by dilation. P2 can be written as a point union, a line, and the union of a plane, an affine plane. And I will choose this point to be that point. In that A1, in that affine line, I choose another fixed point. And in that plane, I choose another torus fixed point. And I will associate these elliptic classes to, there are two vocabularies. Either I associate them to the fixed points, or I associate them to these cells. In the first vocabulary, we call it is the elliptic class of that cell. In the second vocabulary, we call it the stable envelope associated to that fixed point. So these are just different names of the same object. Well, it's not a triviality that they are the same, it's a theorem. But anyway, they are the same. So these three objects, they live in the equivariant elliptic cohomology of T star P2. And there are two definitions known in the literature. The one that came second in chronologically is a geometric definition, a joint work with Andre Weber, that I will not talk about today. So this is my second talk at an elliptic cohomology conference. My first one was at Urbana-Champaign, and that time I talked about this. Maybe some of you were there. So this is where today's talk connects to that talk. So these elliptic classes can be defined the way I defined them that way, which is a sort of a representation theory twist on the Borisov-Rigobert construction of elliptic classes. I will not talk more about it. I want to say a little bit about the other definition, which came first, which came before our definition. It's called stable envelope definition. It comes out of Okunkov's works. The cohomology version was with Maulig, the elliptic version with Aganagic. So the way it is defined is the following, that you are not naming the elliptic class explicitly in the equivalent elliptic cohomology of the moduli space, but you restrict that class to the torus fixed points. So consider the elliptic equivalent elliptic cohomology of the torus fixed points. And if there's a class here, you can restrict to each of the torus fixed points. It turns out that you're not working with torsion. So it turns out that this map is injective. So if you name the three restrictions, then you named that class. Of course, you have to name a very particular triple so that it comes from an elliptic class there. Anyway, the Okunkov in Okunkov theory, the stable envelopes are defined in such a way that you put constraints on these triples. You put some required axioms that they must satisfy. And before naming those axioms or suggesting what those axioms are, I want to show a slide about the theory behind, or which made Okunkov come up with this definition. So in this Okunkov theory, there is a bijection set up between cohomology K theory or elliptic cohomology of some moduli spaces on one hand, and on the beta algebra of some quantum integrable systems on the other hand. So the beta algebra of a quantum integrable system, the ones that come out, they come from some quantum groups, but at the end of the day, it is just a Hilbert space with some commuting Hamiltonians acting. So from the definition, such a beta algebra, so the vector space itself has a coordinate basis, which is called spin basis. But since there is commuting Hamiltonians act, it also has an eigenbasis called beta basis. So this bijection that Okunkov sets up, it is set up in such a way that the eigenspaces maps to the classes of the fixed points. So it is a natural thing to ask, where does the coordinate basis map under this isomorphism or identification? And that's what Okunkov names stable envelopes. And from properties of the spin basis on the right-hand side, he wrote down axioms that these classes must satisfy. So this is just a background for those where is the representation theoretic root of these Okunkov definition for the elliptic classes. Okay, I want to say a few words about the axioms, but I will do it through this example. I continue this example. This example is again T star P2. Again, it has the three fixed points. The equivalent parameters, which come from the torus, are denoted by U1, U2, U3, and the dynamical parameters that we are forced to consider are denoted by U1, U2, U3. Okay, the stable envelope of one point, so the stable envelope of this fixed point, is this triple. So at fixed point one, it is this restriction, at fixed point two it's zero, at fixed point three it's zero. So if you work in similar versions of equivalent elliptic cohomology as I do, then you recognize that this is some kind of Euler class, elliptic Euler class. Anyway, so the elliptic class of A1, of a line whose closure is P1, that is this triple. And the elliptic class of A2 is this triple. So I want to make a few remarks. One is that the first remark I want to make is that you cannot just randomly name triples because they must satisfy some consistency. So if you plug in U1 equals U2 in both of these restrictions, then these two restrictions must agree. And let's see if it's true. So if I plug in U1 equals U2, then this cancels. So this factor will be just a tetra H, and that's there. And if I plug in U1 equals U2, then this cancels. So this factor is the same as that factor. So this just cancels. And indeed, on the left-hand side, I will tetra H, tetra U2 over U1, and tetra H, tetra U2 over U1. So this kind of consistencies have to happen between coordinates, different components of the same elliptic class. That was just one remark. Another remark I want to make is now, so what are these, what are the nature of the axioms, of the Yokunkov axioms? One is that these diagonal restrictions, they have to be some kind of Euler classes. This is the Euler class of the normal bundle of the point in P2. This is the Euler class of the conurbal bundle of A1 in T star of P2, and so on and so forth. So the diagonal restrictions are some explicit Euler classes. Another condition that, another axiom that is that defines these elliptic classes is some kind of support condition. Support condition makes sure that these restrictions are zero. We have some triangular matrix, but also it forces some divisibilities. So in any diagonal term, if you choose the factor which has an h in it, then that one must occur in this whole column as a factor. That, I know this might sound mysterious, but that is some kind of support condition, that the support of the elliptic class of an open variety has to be in the union of some conurbal bundles below that variety in some sense. So that's an axiom. And the third axiom is some kind of smallness, which in cohomology and K-theory would be already satisfied because of the existence of these factors. But in elliptic cohomology, the smallness condition is really just fixing that these theta functions are sections of which bundles. So in the axioms, you have to fix which bundles, which line bundles, which line bundles are such that these theta functions are sections of over some product of elliptic curves. All right, so for the details, I suggest you need to read very technical papers, but this was my explanation of the axioms that these classes must satisfy in that language to be the elliptic classes of some natural varieties on P2. Any questions? If there's a question in chat, will somebody let me know? I guess.
Yeah, I'll let you know if there's a question in chat.
Okay, cool. Okay. So I think at this point I'm ready to be a little bit more precise about how the duality works for elliptic characteristic classes. And this is again through an example. So I'm considering the same example, the T star P2, which we saw the characteristic classes. These are the characteristic classes. I renormalized them a little bit. I got rid of the denominators, that is necessary. And also I reparametrized the torus. That is innocent, but we will come back to it later. According to our theorem, this, as a special case of our theorem, this is the 3D mirror dual of that variety. This is a Nakajima quiver variety. And it also has three fixed points. And the three fixed points have these three elliptic classes. So the theorem, the phenomenon that connects these two is that these two matrices are the same. If you transpose one of them, you replace H with H inverse, and then you replace equivariant parameters with Kähler parameters. So when on some very early slide I said that the elliptic classes are the same, that's somewhat of a cheating. There is a transpose involved. And that was predicted by Okunkov and collaborators and probably by many physicists. Okay, so you see that this is working. So for example, here you see Z2 over Z1. Here you see mu2 over mu1. Here there is H squared denominator, H squared numerator. Or this will be matched with that. And so on. So miraculously, these fixed point restrictions of elliptic classes on one variety are the transpose of the fixed point restrictions of the elliptic classes on another variety. Now I came to the main topic of the talk, the Bo varieties. And I want to be a little bit more detailed. I'm fascinated by Boole varieties. There is very little literature. It's a very new subject. So one of my goals of this talk is just to advertise Boole varieties. There are beautiful subjects, beautiful varieties that make certain things that I have been thinking about for many years much clearer. Anyway, so a Boole variety is associated to a combinatorial object called a brain diagram. A brain diagram is like this object that you have a segment with some decorations on it. Some of the decorations are vertical lines, those you call D5 brains. Some other decorations are slanted lines, and those you call NS5 brains. These little segments that connect five brains, because of course these and these together are called five brains. So these little segments that connect the five brains are called D3 brains. And D3 brains come with multiplicities. So that's part of the combinatorial code. Actually, probably the right physical way of thinking would be that there are two D3 brains here, I think. But whatever, let's call it just this D3 brain has multiplicity two. Of course, in physics, these objects are not really one-dimensional like in this combinatorial code, but higher as these numbers suggest. But this will be enough for today's lecture. Anyway, so this combinatorial code, a brain diagram, Cherkis associated a variety, X sub B. B is the code. And then Nakajima Takayama paper reinterprets this definition using the notion of quivers. I'm cheating a little bit. I'm sweeping some of the structure under the carpet. You need to fix some stability parameters and so on and so forth. But since I'm only working with type A objects, I can fix some stability parameters. Say everything is increasing from left to right or something like that. So I'm not giving you the full story. There's a little bit more, but it's enough for today. So to the combinatorial object, we have a variety. This variety has some decorations. It has a holomorphic symplectic form on it. It has a torus section. The components of the torus are in bijection with the D5 brains. So these objects are the C star actions. And there is one more C star acting somehow that we call C star H bar. This variety also comes with some bundles over it, which we call sides. They are associated to the D3 brains, and the ranks of these bundles are these multiplicities. These we call the tautological bundles. They are in bijection with the D3 brains. All right, now you would like to know how is this variety constructed. I say a few words about the Cherkis definition. So in the original Cherkis definition, the Boole variety is a moduli space, of unitary instantons on some very special spaces. So that means that an element is a gauge equivalence class of objects. These objects are called Boole solutions. A Boole solution is a tuple of some linear maps, a Hermitian connection, and there has to be lots of constraints among those objects. Some of the constraints, the main constraints that sort of is behind the structure is Nam's equation. So this definition, I don't fully understand, but this is the original definition, which is reworded by Nakajima Takayama, and that uses the language of quivers. I'm going to sketch this definition. So in this definition, whenever you see a D5 brain, with A and B as multiplicities on the two sides, then you consider the vector space of linear maps from CB to CA that I indicate by this arrow. You also consider this vector space, that vector space. So home CB, C, home C, CA. Also you consider the endomorphisms from CB to CB. So you add together all these vector spaces, you get a bigger vector space. You do it at every D5 brain. You add all of them together. Now at every NS5 brain with multiplicities A and B on the two sides, you consider this home space and that home space and add all of them together and add all of these vector spaces together. So you will get a large vector space. On that vector space, from that vector space, you cut out some variety by some equations, and call them commuting equations, something like there are three ways of going from here to here. You can go this way, you can go this way, or you can go that way. And the sum of these three have to be zero or something along those lines. That's what I mean by commuting equations. These are indeed, those who speak the language of GIT, these are the preimage of zero or some other element of some real and complex moment maps. So you cut out some equations coming from the structure of this diagram, of these diagrams and this diagram. You also fix some open conditions, they are called stability conditions. And so this variety that are cut out by the moment equations, you throw away some small part of it, you just keep an open part of it. And then this open part you cut down by the product of general linear groups at every D3 brain. This is the definition of the Bo variety. Again, of course, for the details you have to read the paper. It's quite delicate. But my point is that do we really need to know the definition in detail so that we work cohomologically with this variety? So let's go back to an example of a Grassmannian. What do we really need to know about the Grassmannian so that we can do algebraic combinatorics or characteristic classes on its cohomology? Well, we need to know some elements in its cohomology, but they are supplied by the fact that there are some tautological bundles over Grassmann 2C5, there is a tautological 2 bundle. So the churn classes of that are elements in the cohomology. And also, since a torus is acting, we have the equivariant parameters. The whole algebra is algebra over this ring. The cohomology algebra is a module over this ring. So we can name many elements in the cohomology, same in K-theory and elliptic cohomology. We also want to have an understanding of the torus fixed points in that. And for the Grassmannian, the torus fixed points are just two element subsets of the set 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are the coordinate two planes of C5. That's fine. So here we had some combinatorial description. We also need to know how the churn roots of the tautological bundle specialize at fixed points. And it's easy. If the fixed point is, say, 1, 3, then the two churn roots of the tautological bundle, they specialize to U1, U3. So we need some kind of combinatorial or algebraic description of the specializations of tautological bundles at torus fixed points. And then we also need some knowledge about the tangent bundle usually, but that we learn in school, that the tangent bundle of the Grassmannian can be expressed in terms of the tautological bundles. Anyway, these are the main ingredients of working with the cohomology or K-theory or elliptic cohomology of the Grassmannian. So when I started to study Bo varieties, I was looking for these. And that's what I will present in the next few slides. First, I'm going to show you the combinatorial codes for torus fixed points. So whatever is black here is the Bo variety. A torus fixed point is a diagram like this in red. A diagram consists of these arcs, or call them ties. Every tie connects to five brains, but the five brains have to be of different type. So this tie connects this NS5 brain with this D5 brain. And this tie connects such. Also, I want to emphasize that this is a set. It is not permitted to repeat a tie. A tie can only come once. And this diagram altogether has to satisfy that each position of a D3 brain is covered exactly as many times as its multiplicity. So this is 2, so it is covered 2 times. This is 4, this is covered 4 times. This is 2, this is covered 2 times. So you can imagine that if you see whatever is black in this diagram, and your issue is or your problem or your task is to find the fixed points, then you have to do some combinatorics to find these arrangements of ties which are consistent with the multiplicities. All right, so actually from now on, I will restrict the attention to Bo varieties whose brain or Bo varieties that have fixed points. For example, if you write down this Bo variety, it's very simple.
I think there's a question in the chat.
Yes, go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt you or anything, but isn't there some algorithm for these Hanani-Witten brain diagrams to simplify them and put them in some sort of canonical form?
Yep, it's coming. It's coming.
Oh, okay, cool. Thanks.
Good. Yeah. I'm not very convinced about normal form, but yeah. Let's discuss it in 10 minutes.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. Okay, so what I want to say is that not every Bo diagram has a fixed point. For example, this has no fixed point. Because again, I want to emphasize that that you cannot repeat a tie. Okay, so one good thing about those which have fixed points is that the corresponding varieties are smooth. I want to show some physical intuition that I don't fully understand. Let me say, which I don't understand about these fixed points. So my physicist friends say that the way I should think about these ties is that the five brains are actually not fixed. Oh, but yeah, first I should say that we use these slanted and vertical lines, but they are really just pictures from a calculus book. The slanted line is a line parallel with the y-axis. And it is not fixed at a certain position, but it can move within a vertical plane. And the D5 brains, they are also lines in this three-dimensional calculus book picture, but it can move in this vertical plane. And the ties, the D3 brains are somehow lines which can connect far away five brains. But of course they have to cover the right number of the segments. So this is 2, 1, 2. So this is a picture of this combinatorial code, but it contains also the information about a fixed point that I connected these two, and this two, and these two. So some physicists say, and I would be happy if somebody explained this to me, that since this tie connects a vertical and the and horizontal five brain, it's fixed, it cannot move. As opposed to if it connected two vertical brains, then it could go move up and down. Anyway, so I this is just some intuition that maybe many of you understand much better than I do. Right. So that's the combinatorial description of fixed points. And then I want to tell you the fixed points restriction. So we need to know how these tautological bundles or churn roots of those bundles restrict at fixed points. Oh yeah, I have to start with that. Ignore everything in this slide which is in blue. I know that this is a paradox. So actually ignore everything which is in blue above this line. So ignore these parts. This is cut out from a paper, but okay, whatever. Anyway, so these dotted lines together is the fixed point, and there is a combinatorial algorithm to associate variables to portions of these ties, and the fixed point restrictions are such that the churn roots of this tautological bundle are mapped to U1 and U2. U1 and U2 are equivalent parameters. The churn roots of this one, they move to U2, U2 times H, U5 over H squared, U2 H squared. The combinatorial algorithm to write these objects to the segments of the ties is not obvious. So for example, the one starting of this U5, you start with a U5, the next one is U5 over H, U5 over H squared, but then you stay at U5 over H squared because you pass through a D5 brain, not an NS5 brain. So if you want to see the details of this combinatorial algorithm, which generalizes some Nakajima Kruger story, then it's in our paper. Anyway, so this is done. So fixed point restrictions are combinatorial. The tangent bundle description is rather obvious from the Nakajima Takayama description. You add together some home bundles. You add together some home bundles. You subtract some other home bundles, and that is the tangent bundle. There is an important point here that the description, just like for the Grassmann, involves a subtraction. But at the end of the day, this is a bundle. This is not a virtual bundle. So every time you restrict that tangent bundle to a fixed point like this, all the negative signs must vanish. That's a reality check for your combinatorial formulas. And then we come to this story that Arnav already suggested. Well, that will be the second operation, because I will show two operations that you can carry out on brain diagrams and hence on the Bow varieties. The first one is the mirror. It's an innocent thing. Just replace D5 brains with NS5 brains. So if there was a D5, NS5 brain replaces with D5 brains, and don't change anything else. This is a very clear object, but the mysterious observation is that the fixed points, the combinatorial fixed point description, is the same on the two sides of the mirror. Because you remember the essential constraint on a fixed point was that every tie must connect two different 5 brains. But if this tie connects two different, then of course this one connects two different 5 brains as well, and of course there are others. So there's a bijection between the torus fixed point, which is very good news. Before seeing the Bow varieties and trying to find 3D mirror duals among Nakajima Kruger varieties, already matching the fixed points was a non-trivial combinatorial task. But here comes the Hananewita move that Arnav alluded to. So there's an important operation on Bow varieties. If you see two consecutive 5 brains, and D5 brain and NS5 brain, you can replace them. The price you pay is that the multiplicity in the middle changes according to this formula. If you carry out that change, then the theorem is that the Bow variety doesn't change, it stays isomorphic. Actually, that's how it is in the Nakajima and Cherkis papers, but if you consider the torus action as well, then you have to reparametrize the torus. So as torus manifolds, you have to twist the torus action to make this isomorphism true. But that's the mysterious object, that if you carry out such a Hananewita move, then Bow variety doesn't change. So let's see an example. Let me start 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is a Bow variety. I'm going to carry out a Hananewita move here. But before doing that, let me explain the physical reason of this formula. This formula is forced by the fact that we want to conserve something called brain charge. The brain charge of a brain is defined as the number of opposite type 5 brains to the left of the brain plus this multiplicity minus that multiplicity. So for example, the brain charge of this brain is 0 plus 2 minus 0, that's 2. The brain charge of this brain is 1, because there is one opposite 5 brain to the left, plus 2 minus 2, so it's 1. And this is also 1, this is 1, etc. So when we carry out the Hananewita move, so I'm replacing those two, then I want to keep these brain charges, that this had charge 1, and I want to keep having that charge 1. And that forces me to have this to be 1, because the charge of this is the number of NS5 brains to the left, which is 0, plus 1 minus 0. That's the way to make it 1. And okay, so getting this one out of these numbers is that formula. Anyway, so if you carry out this Hanani-Witten move, then your Bo variety only changes by a twist of the torus. There is also a natural bijection between the torus fixed points before and after the Hanani-Witten move. This is this natural bijection between torus fixed points is illustrated in this picture. So imagine that before the Hanani-Witten move, this was your torus fixed point. And if you carry out this obvious rearrangement of the ties, then it turns out that this new arrangement will respect exactly the brain charge preservation. Okay, so let's recall another theorem, is that how are Nakajima quiver varieties special cases of Bo varieties? What happens is that in Nakajima quiver varieties, you have these are the building blocks of quiver varieties. And if you replace that picture with this picture, you put two NS5 reins because of these two, and you put four D5 reins in between. So you put four D5 reins because of that framing being four. And because of these two, you add these multiplicities to be two. Then you get a Bo diagram, and the theorem is that the Nakajima variety encoded by this combinatorics is the same as the Bo variety encoded by this combinatorics. Notice that the Bo varieties you obtain are very special. They are such that in between neighboring NS5 brains, the multiplicities are all the same. This condition is called covalence condition. These are very special Bo varieties. Okay, now we are ready to play some little combinatorial games. Let's start with the cotangent bundle of Grassmann 2 C5. This is the Nakajima code of that is this. I just explained how to create a Bo variety picture out of that. And this is it. So this is just one vertex. You have just one segment of two consecutive NS5 brains, and you put, okay. So if you carry out the mirror symmetry on that, then you replace NS5 brains with D5 brains. And we know that this is the mirror. This is not co-balanced, but we might be lucky, and you probably see the whole page, that we will be lucky that we will be able to carry out Hanani-Witten moves to make it a quiver variety. If I carry out a Hanani-Witten move here, that actually we saw two slides above. Then I carry out a Hanani-Witten move here, then I carry out a Hanani-Witten move there, then one there. And what I obtained is co-balanced here and co-balanced here as well. So it translates to a quiver variety. Now we can suspect that the elliptic stable envelopes in this are the same as the elliptic stable envelopes in that, in the complicated sense, you know, that involves transpose and the switch of equivalent and Keeler parameters. But a little trouble is that these elliptic stable envelopes are not defined for Bo varieties. They are only defined for quiver varieties at the moment. So of course, this is our plan. This is our work in progress to define them and make this complicated proof to be just the net effect of some simple observations. This is a plan. I think I'm just explaining the very same story in an earlier picture, is that we started with a Bo variety. We found this mirror as a Bo variety. Then we carried out several Hanani-Witten moves, and that was a quiver variety. And this is the duality that we proved without knowing this whole story. Oh, I think at this point, I hope I gave some indication of how these numbers 2 and 5 determine this picture. This is exactly through the composition of these two operations, this mirror symmetry and the Hanani-Witten moves. just to appreciate this 3D mirror symmetry. These two varieties have different dimensions, different groups act on them. They have different number and rank topological bundles over them. Their fixed points are, of course, the same, and there's a natural bijection between the fixed points. The other example that I showed, for which we could prove, of course, the elliptic characteristic class duality. These two varieties have different dimensions, different groups act on them, there are different bundles, but of course, there's a natural bijection between the torus fixed points. I think I have like 9 minutes left. I might skip this side, and I just want to just summarize this work in progress that is partially proved and lots of other examples worked out. That we need a good notion of elliptic characteristic classes for Bow varieties, or stable envelopes for Bow varieties. At the moment, stable envelopes, elliptic stable envelopes are defined for Nakajima pure varieties. And after we have that convenient notion, I want us to prove that the stable envelopes on one side of the mirror symmetry are the same as the stable envelopes on the other side of the mirror symmetry, with the usual caveat. But I want this proof to be easy. I expect that this should not depend on sophisticated theta function analysis. It should just follow essentially combinatorially. That is my hope, and probably the phi trisecond identity of theta functions. But if you believe me that indications are that this should follow somewhat easier than the existing proofs in special cases, then you may ask, why are these special cases so difficult? If you saw this paper of ours, you probably agree that the theta function analysis is not obvious there. And this is my last argument I want to make. I want to argue that when we carry out a Hanani-Witten move, then the way of naming characteristic classes just explodes. I want to give an example. What do I mean by this? So this is a Bow diagram before Hanani-Witten, and this is after Hanani-Witten. This bundle in the middle will be a difference bundle. So it's a formal difference bundle. So if you name the cohomology class or K-theory class or elliptic class before Hanani-Witten move, you essentially name the symmetric function in the churn roots of this bundle. So B prime, I start here. So you name the cohomology class, you name the symmetric function in the churn roots of B prime. To name the same class here, then you have to name the same symmetric function, but not in some variables, but in a difference of alphabets, because you have to name these churn roots minus those churn roots. And if you have some experience working with symmetric functions, then you might write a symmetric function, you consider even a very simple symmetric function like a Schur function, and you plug in some difference of alphabets. This B and A have nothing to do with the B and A. It's just different of alphabets. And you want to write it as symmetric functions in the alphabets themselves, then you know, it explodes. You will have sums parametrized by trees and graphs and combinatorics. So this is my hope that these characteristic class formulas that we see, they are disguised by Hanani-Witten move. In the right Bow diagram in its Hanani-Witten class, those formulas should be simple, and that gives us some hope of maybe this 3D duality in the right setting is easier to prove. Okay, I think that's what I wanted to talk about. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard. Let's give Richard a round of applause.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Maybe I can ask, what is the role of holomorphic symplectic structure in this story? I mean, is it just it's constrained combinatoric somehow here? Or?
Yeah, it does. And I don't think I can give a very brief answer, but I have to say that the torus that acts on these, okay, so the torus that acts on these varieties, they have two parts. One that preserves the holomorphic symplectic form and one that scales it. So H is the one that scales it. The rest must preserve the holomorphic symplectic form. So it's like in the Cotangent Bandeau story, a big chunk of the torus must keep the zero section. Mm-hmm. And it's just the induced map on the Cotangent Bandeau. It has pretty many other rules as well. Mm-hmm. But for the characteristic classes, I'm not sure I can say more.
I didn't really understand what's special about elliptic cohomology in this context. Is there a sort of restriction to K theory?
Yes. So
what is the K theory story like?
Right. I want to give at least a 1 minute answer because the answer is fascinating, I think. But for that, I'm going to share my screen again.
Okay.
Okay, so there is a notion of fundamental class, and there is the H-deformed one.
Mm-hmm.
And you can consider them in theory, cohomology and elliptic cohomology. And of course, this is the old story where, Thom polynomials and Quiver polynomials and Schubert calculus and stuff like that happens. And that generalizes to K-theory, but there is a theorem that this does not generalize. There is no elliptic fundamental class. Mm-hmm. But luckily, in the past 2-3 years, it turned out that the H-deformed version exists. This is called the Chern-Schwarz-McPherson class, Chern class, and it has a generalization here, the elliptic class. Uh-huh. I'm getting to your question. I'm sorry that it sounds like I'm answering your question. There's an elliptic class, but here you have to pay a role. You have to pay a price. You must pay a price. But the price you pay is that it must depend on some new parameters.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually consider this with those parameters as well, but you can consider them without them by plugging in mu equals, I don't know, once. You plug in mu equals once, and then you get the what is Motivic Chern class. And same with cohomology. So in CSM and Motivic Chern class, we were not forced to consider those new parameters, but the elliptic version only works with this new parameters. If you plug in u equals one, then it has a pole. So that's another way of saying that there is no elliptic fundamental class. So the elliptic world is where we were forced to consider these new ones. We could have done it, but I was not smart enough to consider it there. But here we were forced. So we noticed the symmetry. I hope it answers the question. So again, I'm just repeating myself. In the elliptic land, we couldn't do without the new parameters. And then the theory was just richer.
Okay, thank you.
But the theory specializes. So if you know the elliptic H-deformed class, you carry out algebraic object and you get the Motivic Chern class, the K-theory fundamental class, the CSM class, and the cohomology fundamental class. Of course, when we found these elliptic classes that depend on new parameters, then we kept asking each other that, what do they mean? What is their topology? What is their geometry? And at this point, my best answer is that these are equivalent parameters on the mirror dual.
From 0 to 1?
No, these are equivariant parameters. These are equivariant variables on the mirror pair.
Mm-hmm. Are they connected at all with the Hasse invariant for an elliptic curve?
I mean, not that I know of. No, I don't know.
I mean, that's for an elliptic curve. They can be ordinary or super singular, and that's determined by the Hasse invariant at the prime p. It's something like e sub p minus one, and that's the main thing. If you think of elliptic cohomology as a deformation of K-theory in terms of modular forms, it's basically that modular form that measures the difference, but it depends on the prime that you're working at.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I don't know anything along those lines. Okay. Maybe the last thing is that this mirror symmetry I keep talking about is the D equals 3 and equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theory mirror symmetry. I see some old friends and co-authors in the audience.
Oh, may I ask a question about your conjecture about the elliptic stable envelope for Bohr varieties?
Yes.
So for the Bohr variety, isn't there the hyperbolic restriction can give you those classes?
Maybe you are right. I'm not sure. I don't know.
So, and also for the like a Gimacuil variety for other lead types, is that a special case for the Bohr variety?
That I don't know. I don't expect that they would be special cases of the type A Bohr variety. I imagine there are other types of Bohr varieties. But of course, there we have one more result that in other types, for the full flag variety of other types, they are dual to the full flag variety of the Loglund dual type. So that theorem doesn't fit into this Bohr variety story that I am explaining. This is absolutely type A story.
Mm-hmm.
For elliptic stable envelopes, for Bohr varieties, of course, for Nakajima-Quill varieties, one constructs a hypertoric resolution and then pushes forward things. So that is my way of approaching it.
Oh, yeah, sorry. So for this hyperbolic restriction, I think it's only worked for cohomology instead of elliptic. Uh-huh. Elliptic type, yeah. Yeah, thanks.
So Richard, can you say something about algorithms to compute these elliptic classes and whether they refer just to the flag variety or to Nakajima-Quiver varieties?
Right. So if you fix one space like a partial flag variety, then you and I and many people know that there are some different recursions. So if you name one elliptic class, then you apply some R matrix or some Hecke operation, and then you can recover the others. But those recursions can also be solved and given a formula for partial flag varieties. So if you name a partial flag variety and a combinatorial code of a fixed point, then I give you a formula. It's actually the Tarasov-Varchenko weight function formula, which is the answer.
So the
question can be translated that for like a Nakajima-Quill variety, is there a formula or is there a recursion? And both exist. There is R matrix recursion. Okay, so for partial flag variety, you might know that there are two recursions. There is the R matrix recursion and there is the Hecke recursion or Botsamelson recursion. So that second is very special for full flag varieties. But for Nakajima-Quill varieties, the R matrix recursion works. That was the a main point of Mauli Kokunkov, that these R matrices are sort of geometric in their story. But what the R matrix is, I don't know. They have to work this out. I'm not sure. You have to go to the representation theorist side and find the R matrix. But what I really want to say is that there is a generalization of the weight function. It's a terrible formula. And we give it in our paper with Varchenko, Smirnov, Zhu for type A quiver varieties. It's a summation on trees. So you name certain permitted type of graphs, and then you set up a summation for those graphs, and then you define 10 million combinatorial functions and you add them together, and that is the elliptic class. It's not very satisfying.
But that comes from some recursion or?
No, that particular comes from resolution. So you resolve the Nakajima quiver variety and of course with this slope in it to be a hypertoric variety.
Okay.
So this summation on trees, every tree represents a fixed point in the resolution.
Have you or any of your co-authors or anyone else in the area looked at some of Trichus's other constructions like periodic monopoles or doubly periodic monopoles? I expect that there's some kind of higher dimensional version of these Bow varieties as well, given by D4 and S5 configurations wrapped on a circle.
I think you asked the same question when you visited UNC. I just don't know.
Can I give a talk?
Yeah, of course.
To myself? When we met. No, sure. Okay.
Yeah, you gave a talk and then we met before.
Right. So no one has done any of these computations yet, I gather.
Not that I know of. Right. Of course, Lev is the right person to ask, but I think he's also the Lev Rozanski. But at this point, he's doing the Bow varieties.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because then it would be very interesting to me if you still get elliptic cohomology as the right home for these things, or some kind of SL3Z automorphic type data that I know Varchenko has dealt with in the past.
That's okay, yeah. Very good ideas, I don't know.
Any other questions?
Of course. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I can see one in the chat. I'm just gonna read it. It says these brain diagrams and their duality can be interpreted via an M-theory relift as given pairs X, comma, D, where X is a three-color BL and D is a divisor, which in a sense affinizes the representation theory, have the combinatorics of types, et cetera, being interpreted in the latter context.
I think that's where the story is coming from. I have very partial understanding of this M-theory interpretation, but I think that's where it's coming. So I'm talking to physicist Lev Rozanski, and then he's telling me these stories, and then I translate it to characteristic classes. I think this is the same story, but I cannot add more to that.
Thanks. Any other questions? I sort of wanted to ask, On this Bow variety side, you have this way of assigning the weights to all these fixed points, and there's this complicated rule. But is it somehow like related to like how you read the coefficient of R matrices?
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's indeed a somewhat sophisticated combinatorial rule, but it's much simpler for quiver varieties, but it's still combinatorial there. In quiver varieties, you consider some kind of partitions growing out of those framings, and you fill out those the boxes of the partitions in a very, very natural way, that you shift by age, you go that way, and you don't shift by age, you go that way. So I expect that is not where the R matrix is living. So the R matrix story is related to the part of the theory which I hid, is that everything I did, I fixed the chamber. For partial fragmentations, I fixed the full frame, the frame, the reference frame. So if you change the reference frame, or you change the chamber, then there are new stable envelopes, and the new stable envelopes relate with the old stable envelopes by the R matrix. So in everything, for the sake of understandability, I fixed the chamber and I pretended that there was only one.
Yeah, that makes sense. But on the other hand, this is sort of this mysterious thing. Like if you look at this example that you had at the very beginning, this potential bundle to class bonding case, you can sort of so you have the observation where you can sort of start from one, and you get the others, and there's this rules that sort of looks like they sort of like where the poles and the zeros are of the R matrices should be. Is this sort of some coincidence, or is there some kind of a reason?
I think it's a coincidence. I think it was a very symmetric, small example, I think.
Yeah.
But interesting observation. I'll look into it. Thank you, Kuban.
Are there any other questions? All right. Let's thank Richard one more time. Thanks for this wonderful talk.
Thank you. Good morning, Australia. Have a nice day.
Yeah.